Welcome to What's Left, a weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left.
I'm Eduardo Barca with Andy Lipson.
Today, we will finally be talking about our long-awaited topic of identity politics. And this is going to be one where I think we will finally answer some of our listeners' questions. If you've read some of the previous comments that people have had, especially one I remember particularly on the former ISO YouTube video, and also just friends that have our friends and community personally have questions, because we sometimes people don't understand where we're coming from. And I think, I personally think they are a little, especially here in San Francisco Bay Area, they are a little overcome by a blanket of liberal thoughts, which normally tend to be around political identity politics.
And I think both of us have had anxiety about this episode, about the subject. And I think it's worth us talking about that beforehand, right? Okay.
Yeah, I do think you're right. But whoever can go first about it and why?
Whoever goes first. Should I go first?
I'll go first.
First of all, this is difficult because I do think that the dominant political ideology for fighting racism is identity politics or intersectionality, which we're not, I don't think we're going to quite discuss, although I don't know enough about intersectionality to know the difference between intersectionality and identity politics. I have some ideas about that, but I do think that the identity politics framework is the dominant framework. It's a liberal framework. It's a dominant framework, or I consider it a liberal framework. It's a dominant framework for talking about fighting oppression, racism, sexism, gender oppression, and in my mind, it is not the framework I come from in fighting those things. And often when I say that, in fact, I had a recent conversation with a colleague of mine who, when I said that I don't believe in white privilege, that I don't ascribe to that notion because I do think it's a connection to identity politics, she was very upset with me. And she's a person who I worked with for a long time. And she was like, well, you can't, she's a woman of color. And she said, well, you cannot be an ally of mine in the fight against racism or anti-Muslim oppression or Islamophobia. I don't agree with her, but that's how she sees it. And I do think, I think the position that I have is a fairly lonely one. It didn't always be that way. The Marxist position was not an identity politics position around how to fight racism and oppression. But I think most Marxists have made a lot of concessions to identity politics. So now I feel on my own, and now I'm attempting to kind of find my way as a revolutionary, as a Marxist on this. And so I hope to get this right. I hope to be able to describe what I think we're going to have to say what we think identity politics is, and I think we'll get part of it right. I think people who really know these politics better will maybe say, oh, they missed this, they missed that. That's fine, but what I hope to do is describe what my beliefs are about the fight against racism and sexism and oppression and how I see it as connected to the fight against capitalism and the fight for socialism. So I have anxiety about it because I think I can get it wrong and I feel alone on it. And I've already, like you said, we live in sort of I feel like I live in a stew of identity politics, and to say that I don't believe it, I think is often heard as, I don't believe in racism. So those are some anxieties that I have.
Yeah. Well, I think this video will be one of the most crucial videos we will have of all of our What's Left episodes that we have had. I want just to remind listeners, that what I will be sharing and what Andy will be sharing is our own. We are not thinking, right? I want just to be very clear that we're not thinking as a we're not thinking as the same.
Yes.
We might be divided on some things. And so I just wanted to preface that to say that what I will be speaking from will be from me, Eduardo, and from what I think I have reasoned out and sorted out some of my thoughts, and some I have still doubts, and some I have questions, you know, just, and so I'm not speaking for Andy, and Andy is not speaking for me.
Correct.
So that's what I wanted to preface with, just that before I continue, because it's very, very important that, especially with this subject, that I'm going to say some things that Andy will not be in agreement with, or I might not be in agreement with him, and anything I say belongs to me. Mm-hmm. So I will say that. Right. Now, Andy and I have already had these conversations sort of around, but I don't think that we've really discussed reasons in depth of where we come from around this. And I think that my personal viewpoint will come from how I was raised as a Jehovah's Witness, because that strictly gave me an idea of how to separate people from them versus us. And that was, anyone outside of a Jehovah's Witness was an enemy. Group thinking, ways of separating people, and it worked, and it was an advantage for this organization. And that's where I'm coming from with this, more than any other identity that I loosely hold. And I think I have some anxiety or feel almost hesitant to speak freely around this, mostly because even prior already to this video, talking to some of my friends, some friends that are on the left have felt hurt in our conversations, feeling I don't acknowledge privileges that I hold, or I undermine their experiences as people that are disabled, or people that are, particularly, I know one friend because she's a woman and she grew up poor. And I did not have the same experiences for some other Mexicans, so I don't understand. I've been just many, many, many intersectionalities that I came across in this conversation. So I'm feeling this, for this episode in particular, I'm feeling very careful, but I also know that we are creating the space here on What's Left to have discussions that are not normally had on the left. And that is why we did What's Left.
Correct.
For us to be able to have these discussions that are not being held because everyone plays tribalism and starts ousting and separating people. So I want to say that what I'm going to share is just ideas and ways for us to have conversations, because I believe that political thought is also in that realm of freedom of speech without hurting people, and that we can have these discussions without hurting each other, and that we can have these discussions to open up ideas and unite and see our similarities more than see our differences. So that is how I feel about this. I feel mostly around this issue that, being a person of color, I have been pigeonholed and made to feel like I have to choose almost partisan lines to subscribe to a certain particular thought and idea of how I should think and do things without thinking about it critically on my own, because I am a person of color, or because I am Mexican, or because I am on the coast, on this West Coast, or whatever. And so I don't subscribe to that way of thinking. I subscribe to the thinking that everyone should examine anything, no matter if it's on the right or left, and you should criticize it, and you should discuss it, and you should dissect it, and you should look at it, because I know how it is to subscribe to something without thinking critically about something, when I myself have grown up in a sect, a sectarian religion, when I simply just obeyed and I was not allowed to explore and discuss and question. And I remember feeling very repressed around it and feeling as if I didn't have a voice or I couldn't. And I always had doubts in the back of my head, in the back of my mind. And having that experience really, really gave me the courage and the force to really question everything and not accept anything after that. And I know people have tried to shut me out of my community when I was a Jehovah's Witness, and people have tried to use disciplinarian ways to make me feel invalidated. And so I now am experiencing this through this identity politics lens on the left, where I cannot express anything. We will share experiences. You mentioned one with you felt at work. I have felt similarly at work. One particular experience I remember, I worked in a predominantly all-Latino elementary school, and we were sharing some things, and I think I have shared enough some in this all of our episodes where I'm Mexican, but I grew up middle class, and I had a very good education, public school education. I went to school here, but I went to school in Mexico as well, and I spent my summers in Europe, and I have parents that never worried about immigration because we went back and forth, and those weren't the experiences that they were talking about at my particular school, and they shut me out of those conversations, being Mexican around other Mexicans and other Latinos. And I remember feeling pushed to the side. I thought, even being a person of color, how can I not participate in this conversation? I thought, and I have used this analogy with you, I thought we're playing the game of Uno here. Pulling one card and you're pulling the other, and so we're the same color, no? But these were sort of ways that I started to see how this was not working for me. And that's one experience. Lastly, around my personal issues, or my personal point of view, how I will talk about this, is I do practice meditation. I am a lay Vipassana meditator. I've expressed this in the past. And so exploring the self, exploring the ego, and meditating, really learning to dislayer. How do you say? When you're peeling away layers and layers of your identities, because I used to hold on to certain identities really strongly, and now I hold on to them loosely, and I'll explain more about that later. But unlayering these layers of my identity, really seeing myself as a human and as an imperfect person, and seeing how much more I am similar with other people than how I am different, has really given me greater awareness spiritually. And not spiritually like divine spiritually, but connection that we are one with everyone, whatever color we are, whatever race, however we identify ourselves, we are really all similar and basically fundamentally. So I have those lenses just to give people how I will be speaking from this. So that's all the forms I see this topic.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is important. It's actually, like you said, this is one of those issues. This issue of discussing racism, identity politics, is one of those issues that the left has made, you can't talk about it. It's one of those forbidden subjects in many ways. And there's a lot of fragility on the left around discussing this issue. So I do think that's one of the goals here, is to try to break out of that. And like, I think the fact that you made the analogy of a religious sect, that's something that the left, I think, has imposed. This is one of those areas where the left has imposed a sect-like nature to this subject matter, where this is not up for discussion, this is not up for debate, and that hurts us. So I guess we can think of this as a contribution to trying to break out of that box.
I hope so. Yeah. I do hope that we are contributing to this community.
And for people who think we should be in that box, that we disagree. Yeah. You know, we might agree about the need to fight racism, but I don't think we can do that from inside a box where we just say that's not up for discussion.
Yeah. And I will point out, Andy, as well, that identity politics doesn't belong to the left, although they truly are the ones really advocating, I feel. But it is something that even the right is doing, and we can see this, and we'll bring up examples.
Yeah.
I think nationalism.
Yeah,
you know, everything around this we them mentality. Right.
So And with that preamble, how do you think we should start?
Well, do you have some idea of how we can sort of give our listeners what we mean by identity politics? Maybe we can sort of unscramble what we think, how we understand identity politics. Maybe I'll say, you say, I don't know.
Okay. However, what about starting also with, okay, I would also, this might be, we'll see how we edit.
Yeah. We're improvising.
Yeah. we actually discussed on an earlier What's Left, racism and capitalism.
Yeah.
So I think it's worth saying what are some of the things that I actually re-listened to that. Mm-hmm. And I think it's worth saying that if you listen to that, you'll hear a few things, which is Eduardo and I are not up for a debate. Like we aren't debating does racism exist or sexism exist.
Right.
We don't debate that. We believe it exists. We believe it needs to be fought, right? And opposed. We also don't believe that racism and sexism are biologically determined. That is, it's not genetic. That these things are things that come from our culture, from our history. And that's something that you will hear in that episode. And I can post that episode again.
Yeah, please.
And I'll put times onto it. So those things are not part of our discussion of, like, that's our starting point, actually, is racism and sexism exist, gender oppression exists, ableism exists, transphobia exists, Islamophobia exists. There are so many different oppressions that exist out there. We live in an oppressive system, that is not something that we debate between them. There are people, like you have a friend who does not think that those things exist any longer. Mm-hmm. There are people who do believe that. But we are not one of those people.
Yeah. We've already established this in the episode that we invite people to see on racism.
And also that we don't believe it's inherent, that racism and sexism are inherent. And those views are inherent to people. They don't, that we had to be taught those things. Mm-hmm. And I think we actually both, I think, largely agree that they came from certain historical points of view. Periods, you know, we talked more about racism coming from out of the feature of modern racism came out of the emergence of capitalism and the slave trade and things like that. We didn't so much talk about where sexism came from, but those are things that we both came from pretty much the same point of view on. And I want to start there at least.
Yeah, thank you for saying that, because it is true. I think those are actually, before even we talk about the politics, it is tied to racism, and it is tied to ideas of what we think, what we've already established.
Right, yeah. Right. Because some of the critics of identity politics are critics from the right who actually engage in identity politics, a kind of white nationalism. Mm-hmm. I'm not even talking about Klan here. I'm just saying sort of what about white people, the people who might oppose affirmative action and see that affirmative action is reverse racism and things like that. You don't have to be a member of the Klan to think that. That's a common parlance among sections of the right, among even some Democrats are weak on the question of, you know, affirmative action and things like that. We'll say that, you know, like, well, if people, Chicano or Mexican people can unite, why can't white people unite? Mm-hmm. You know, and they'll ask that question.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And I don't think identity politics has an answer for that question, because mm-hmm. I think the statement is, well, yeah, but that's not where we're coming from. Those people will doubt. They'll tend to say, oh, there's been a black president, women can take power, there's women in Congress. So we live in a post-racist, post-sexist society. And therefore, those people who oppose identity or who disagree with identity politics from that position don't even agree with the need to fight racism and sexism. That's not me. That's not you. Mm-hmm. So we might have different ideas about how to wage that fight. Mm-hmm. And that's what we think is up for the debate here. So,
right.
So maybe let's go ahead and take our stab at identity politics.
All right. Do
you want me to start?
Yeah.
The quickest way I describe identity politics is the idea that only those experiencing a particular form of oppression can either define it or fight it, or that they're the ones who have a material basis, who have an interest in that fight. Mm-hmm. And based on the experience of that oppression, it is that thing which unites them. Which unites people in the opposition to that particular oppression, and that people who don't experience that oppression could be maybe allies, but they don't have a stake in the fight, if you will. Mm-hmm. This is where the issue of privilege comes in, and they might say that a white person benefits from racism against black people, or a male benefits from sexism against women. And it's all women who have a stake in fighting sexism, and all blacks who have a stake in fighting racism as it relates to, there's so many different kinds of racism. I'm just using that example. And secondly, I think I will say this piece as well, is I do think identity politics does not, most people who I know who come from identity politics lens don't say that there's such a, they don't deny classism. They don't deny, they also say there's classism, but they put them all on equal planes. Class divisions, racial divisions, sexual divisions. They just see them all as a bunch of
categories
of divisions, undifferentiated, except to say that they're different. You can fall under one. You can have you can be subject to several of them, but they're all different and don't have any almost. They don't have an almost common basis around which to unite people in any material way. Again, you could be allies. Intersectionality tries to bring these together. I don't understand it well enough to know if it does. I don't think it does. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to try to pretend I say anything about it. So.
And within that category, there are even subcategories, such as if you're black, you have, and we've discussed political privilege in our previous episode.
Yeah, and I'll
please look down.
When I do that, when I post the thing, I'll post times for where you can hear us talking about racism, the origins of it, and privilege.
Yeah, thank you, Andy, for doing that. He's very meticulous on that. Thank you. So even within those categories, there are subcategories. So if you're black, well, you experience light-skinned blackness because you are beautiful and you're more widely accepted because within the community, according to a paper bag, you are most beautiful, more likable. Or if you're Mexican like myself, you know, you're seen as either you, as I was giving the example earlier, I'm more affluent than some other Mexicans because I never experienced the fear of deportation or having gone to different countries to study gives me that privilege or economic class, right? Within that, or even if you're black Mexican versus if you're indigenous Mexican and versus if you're mestizo like I am. So again, it's subcategories and even the gender and sexual diversity community as well. Oh, if you're bisexual, you can still pass as heterosexual when you're with a heterosexual couple. So you might not be considered gay sometimes. So you have that passing. Or if you're trans, you are not easily recognized as a trans woman or a trans man. Then you have the privilege of passing, which other people do not have because they look more manly or they look more feminine and they can tell if they're trans. So within the category, you still have subcategories of other privileges within that. And there is a lot to say about that. But I just wanted to add to, yes, so there's all of this and they're seen. And then on top of that, you still even more subcategories besides those.
Right. And we're starting to get into critiques of it. But I think what the underlying thing is that identity politics seeks to unite people based on their what they say or come a shared experience mm-hmm. of oppression. But the fact is that I don't think you can actually unite people around shared experiences because we all actually, and even within a particular category, all have different experiences.
Yeah.
That is not a basis. It basically breaks everyone up to individuals. And that is the situation of capitalism. Capitalism wants to break us up into individuals. And it also does want to divide us along racial lines and gender lines and things like that. It seeks to do this So, I mean, the idea that what might unite us is some shared experience, I don't think is actually true because we actually have different experiences. Mm-hmm. And so I do think there is a way to unite us or there is a basis around which we are united. But I think that's where we get into things like Marxism and why I'm a Marxist. That's one thing I'll say about that.
Yeah, I just to add on to it, I don't think any one group is a monolith. There aren't similar experiences. I truly believe there is racism, but how racism manifests for each person is different. And I can say this, that my brother and I, who looked different, has experienced different racism than I have experienced racism. And there are many factors to that, but we were raised from the same mother. But All I'm just trying to say is that I think this is the idea that if you are a monolith and you're immediately, there is a stream of filter that when you see someone and they identify this way, there is immediate all these, like I think of it like the credits at the end of a film where all of these things are listed out about you already. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I just wanted to supplement what you had said to that.
Mm-hmm. So I guess first thing I'll say is for what I'll do is I'll talk about my framework for fighting racism and fighting oppression.
From the point of view of?
Of a Marxist.
Yeah.
And here's things that I think, if you don't think that capitalism, like, one, either if you don't think that capitalism is a problem, like, needs to, is this fundamental problem in society, or if you don't think capitalism can be changed, like, capitalism, then you're not going to agree with where I'm coming from. Mm. Like, that is, so, and frankly, if I didn't think capitalism could be overthrown and turned into the dictatorship of the proletariat called the socialism, mm-hmm. then I might actually agree with identity politics as the best way, as everyone has to kind of go into their herd to defend themselves in the context of this brutal competitive system. I might actually be a person who would buy identity politics. Mm-hmm. But because I think identity politics does make sense, if you don't think you can get rid of capitalism, if you don't think the working class is the agent of change, and you don't think socialism, in terms of not socialism as defined by Bernie Sanders, but socialism as working class taking power in its collective class name, pushing the capitalists off the stage of history and running society democratically on an international basis. This is called the dictatorship of the proletariat by mm-hmm. Marx. If you don't believe that that's something that you're trying to fight for, then you're not going to agree with what I'm saying. So I'm just going to say that that's the framework I come from. But that is the framework that I use for fighting all these oppressions, because I think all these oppressions come out of capitalism. Mm-hmm. I think the Frederick Douglass, there's a few things to say about it. Frederick Douglass said that the capitalists divide each to conquer all people, kind of thing. Like he said, they divide both to conquer each.
Mm. Okay. Divide both to conquer each.
Yeah. He was talking about blacks and whites in the South. Frederick Douglass was an abolitionist looking to fight slavery and was a supporter of the Civil War and the fight against slavery through the Civil War. And he saw the method racism as a divide and rule approach that kept the capitalists in power. And I see the same thing. Divide and rule is a time-tested thing used in imperialism, right? Mm-hmm. The British divided Muslim from Hindu and actually put certain Hindus in power against Muslims as a way of ruling them. When the Belgium and the Germans went into Africa, they separated Hutus and Tutsis and basically put one in power and kept the other one out of power mm-hmm. as a basis for ruling. And in the same way that empires have been able to keep, they've been able to be a minority in that country, the British minority or the Belgian minority in Africa, and rule over them. This is how a minority stays in power. It basically separates people and puts one group against the other while ruling over both. And this is why when I say I don't believe in white privilege, I don't actually believe that white workers benefit from the actual fact that while we, as all workers, are oppressed, we all experience essentially minority rule over us. Some workers, black workers, particularly in this country, immigrant workers, workers of color, and women workers experience more oppression, additional oppression in this country. They are more oppressed in this country than maybe a white worker will be on average. But I don't think I don't believe I benefit from that, because I believe that that oppression that my brothers and sisters are experiencing is actually a way that the capitalist stays in power. So that I would basically say that I don't have a stake in keeping that oppression existing. Like, I want it to we need to eradicate it because it's going that keeps that 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 division keeps us from uniting as a working class. And so it keeps us from actually opposing the capitalists as a united group. The people who I do say benefit are the capitalists, and not just white capitalists. Black capitalists benefit from it. Women capitalists benefit from sexism. Black capitalists benefit from racism, the racism of a capitalist system that uses sexism and racism to keep workers divided. Now white workers might think of themselves as benefiting from it, but they're wrong. They don't materially benefit it because this is why, in the same way that the Hutus don't benefit from being put above the Tutsis in Rwanda, nor did the Hindus benefit from being put above the. Now there were a layer in those countries, particularly among the ruling class in those, that did actually benefit. But if you were on the ground, if you were just a worker in India, and you were a Hindu, you didn't benefit from any privileges you might have had over your Muslim brothers, because that those benefits were there, or so-called benefits were there, just to make sure of British rule. And a similar situation exists for the capitalists, and that's how I see the situation for us here globally. So that's what if I was to agree with privilege, I would be agreeing that somehow this is in my interest to keep this system around, to keep these divisions around, and they're not. Because these divisions are what keep all of us from basically making that revolution that we think is necessary, or at least as from a Marxist standpoint, it keeps us from making that socialist revolution that I think is actually necessary.
And what I have to say about this is that I believe that the counter to my stand on the left with a lot of my friends within the community, politically active friends, is that that I want to almost squash the diversity and celebrate the differences that there are. I think that we all come from diverse cultures. I think we all come from diverse experiences and language cultures. And for example, the deaf culture that I'm involved in, and because I know sign language, and the French culture that I have experienced and been with because I speak French, and the Spanish and Mexican and Latino. The thing is, I really do celebrate the diversity that is around us all, and especially here on the coast where we have experience, especially the cities, I think anywhere really you experience this. But I'm not opposed to celebrating it, and I'm not opposed for people to try to get more blacks into the media, such as the actors, or even trying to diversify the art industry, or just creative art in general. I'm not opposed to that, and I want to celebrate as well the differences that there are, that are, I think, nuances that make us humans, that we can sort of look at and point out and share with other people. What I think that the new left, this new movement, this new wave of the left with identity politics, and it was coined by someone that I think I forgot her name, well, put her on the description, was on someone from the left. And what I think has happened is now that there is this idea that to celebrate isn't so much to celebrate, but to show that there is this tribalism to keep people within a certain boundary that they don't want to mix in. And anyone outside of that is, you don't understand, you don't feel me because you don't represent who I am, or you don't live my experiences. And I find that there is something troubling about it, because as I was thinking about this and I was looking at some other content as well out there, it's like saying, how do we see soup? What do we call soup, for example? How can we identify what soup is? Well, one would say that soup is sort of hot, or not hot, or liquid with solids, no? But then what about cereal, no? Is it as well, it's liquid with solids. Would you consider that soup then? Hmm. Then one would say, well, one is cold and one is hot. Well, I know another soup soupy dish that is served cold.
Cold, yeah.
And then you would say, well, what about oatmeal? It's served hot and it's solid and liquid. You know, eventually, if you start trying to identify what makes up an experience, you'll see that it's very hard to go into this, what makes up a certain category, like I was saying earlier as well. So I think that this people have, as they develop the self, I think that people really are looking to find themselves and find who they are. And that begins from development as you're a child. And you form these groups like you do in high school here in the USA, especially. You start forming the goth group, or you start forming a jock group, or you start forming some alternative group. No, so eventually you grow up and then you start forming a your community group. And I do think that there are things that people experience that maybe one is not privy to. For example, people who are left-handed, and we lived in a mostly right-handed world, that some experiences such as scissors, cutting with scissors, or the way that we open doors, or the way that we read. Some things are not, mostly the majority of people are right-handed, so then you have some differences where people are going through life having to accommodate themselves to the majority. I do think that those things exist, and that exist as well for people of color, that exist for people who are disabled and people who are, as I was saying earlier, deaf. And then they find people who, oh, you went through this experience. I've been through this experience myself as well when I was, you know, searching for a type of scissors and I could not find it. And you have the exact scissors that work for me. And that is the shared experience that I think people can sort of celebrate and find the nuances and laugh about, you know, and going through life struggling with that. And sometimes it's not always laughing about. Sometimes you are definitely going through something that it's not, you're not really content, and it's always you against the majority. And I'm sure that those don't feel right and they don't feel well. And I want to respect that. Where I think that that the ego comes in, where this is my identity, this is me, and no one will understand me, and I'm just this person, and you will never understand me, such as when we start talking about oppression. And I know when we are, I'm amongst other people of color, and they exclude white people in this discussion. And when white people leave, like I worked in a school and for a union, I had my union, and then other people of color would wait until white teachers would step out. I remember, and I thought, why are we doing this? That almost felt wrong to me. And people were almost having this secret life around other people. And I didn't know if I felt comfortable with that, because for me, everyone had a stake in how we were being represented. And in this particular experience that I'm mentioning, against administration. And I felt as if we were all having different points of view and we were not being inclusive, which is part of the reason why we were at that time, because I'm mentioning this particular experience, we were trying to topple administration to get rid of a particular principle. We couldn't because we were so divided. Mm. And this did not serve us. And here we stuck with this principle that micromanaged everyone, and that really gave us what some, I didn't consider it hell, but some people called it hell. I'm sure some people got a huge bunt for it. But what happened was, for 7 years, we stuck with administration simply because we couldn't get to any sort of union for ourselves. And we couldn't face difficult conversations that must have been had, because people got really emotional and really personal. And I remember people blocking out, shutting out, or as some people would say, stonewalling others. Because once you're not accepting of a particular frame of thinking or a way of thought, then you are not my ally, as you had said in your own experience, or you are not, we're just not ever going to meet. And this is true for, like I said, for right and left wing sides. Immediately, people start categorizing themselves into Republican and Democrats, or left and right, or, you know, and immediately they subscribe to, if you're Republican, a denial of climate change, or a denial of certain, or even looking at it yourself. If you don't want to agree with it, fine, but even not looking at it, you already subscribe to a certain thought and way of thinking. And on the left as well, you just And I've played those politics before, I will admit. And so I think that it's important for me to be transparent with that as well. And it hasn't worked. I am anti-capitalist. I am discovering, as I have said in other episodes as well, I subscribe to some form of libertarian anarchism. I do have read lots and lots on Noam Chomsky, and I subscribe to that frame of thinking. I'm not sure I can label myself completely as a socialist, as Andy has clearly marked himself and has clearly had developed himself through his own life and through his own experience and slowly gotten to a place. And maybe I will be, I don't know, and I'm not going to speak to that at the moment. But I do think that there is a capitalist class, that's for sure. And I know that I am an anti-capitalist, and I know that the capitalist class has always used the divide and conquer method to keep us separated from each other. That I do know, and that is in history, from the times when whites and blacks, the idea of race came to separate the whites and the blacks from the poorest, because that was a way for them not to unite. And that is happening, and there is history as well. That I forget this moment at this time, but even when the Palestinian workers and the Israeli workers were trying to unite, no, you had to say, I am a Zionist, I am a Israel, I am Israeli, and I am Palestinian, therefore we cannot even achieve, we cannot be friends because of that. And you see this everywhere. Everyone is a nationalist somehow, some way or another. Even in my own country, in Mexico, when there were Central Americans traveling and crossing and immigrating, Mexico first, you heard on the border in my own country. That really bothered me. And this is that idea that we are separate from each other. You are Central American. And here in the USA, I learned that Salvadorians and Mexicans were not to get along or something like that. And I only learned that here. That is, and we're Latino, and there is this division, and even gangs have formed because of it, rivaling themselves. So this is all benefiting whom? The police state, right? And as far as the gangs go, and benefiting the stereotypes that they feed into for the people who are wealthy and say that let them settle out their differences by killing themselves like dogs and cats out there and killing themselves. And they'll eventually die out, hopefully, if they shoot themselves around. And I've seen this black on black, right, where people say, oh, just forget, and it works for them. So I'm someone that is a contrarian, and I believe that even if you have something that could be somewhat controversial, I think you should share it. And I have friends that other friends would hate me for being friends with them because they are sort of a little bit out there with their thinking. But I'm open to listening because I think that communication is very important in our life with anyone to understand. And I think that that is human to think. Maybe I'm so interested in psychologically understanding another person, but I don't want to shut out conversations because otherwise how will I unite them? And maybe the only identity politics I can sort of accept as I was thinking about this is the sort of way that maybe you might not like this, I'm not sure, but Martin Luther King politics, identity politics, which is maybe the good version of identity politics, where Martin Luther King did not separate white people. And he said that white were brothers and brothers and sisters and united them in the same cause. And that's why he was able to get a larger crowd and have people, because it wasn't staunch, I'm black, this is a black revolution, this is a black... He was a very more accepting of a person, everyone. And I think that maybe if I was to subscribe to some form of method of identity politics, this is my way, that I don't think that the right is my enemy. I think of the right as a way, as over there, and I'm not sure where they are coming from, and maybe they're not all subscribing to the same thing. Maybe some of them are just there because they're choosing sides to be on that line because they were told so, and they were raised a certain way, and they have family or community, I don't know. The point is that I'm, all right, let's listen to what you have to say, and where can we, I want to hear it, and how did you come to it? And that is something. Now, there are people who are clearly subscribed to a Nazi form or KKK idea, and they're just, it's not so much of a, it's more of a, I think of someone that is truly mentally, I don't know how to, maybe really, really affected, mentally unstable. And I'm not going to engage with some people who are just not even going to talk or hash things out with you. I'm not interested in that. I consider myself to be part of the working class, and I see myself, we're like in on the same category because of it. I see more similarities together than I see differences, and I know our differences already. But I think I try to find similarities just in general with people, and what that means is that I can find some way that we can work together to, like we're doing now with this, right? This activism where we are doing this, and I'm disagreement with you over ideas, and not because of the color of your skin or because of the color of my skin, but I can debate you because of our ideas. I don't like it or I don't agree with it, I will tell you. Mm-hmm. But not because I will stonewall you because, oh, you don't understand Andy because you're white or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Or the way people have shut me out, I felt. And I have felt that way. People have done that to me. I have mentioned it in my very brief example that I said earlier, where I remember this person, this coworker, this colleague of mine at work. We were part of the same union. And we're all predominantly there where my site, I are Latino. And this person who is Mexican, I'm Mexican, we were talking. And she said to me, I don't even know why you are talking or engaged in this conversation when you have not felt what we or what most of our students feel here. I said, what do you mean? You have never felt the fear of deportation or the fear of growing up that your parents are going to be taken away. I said, well, maybe I didn't feel that, but I felt other things that, you know, my parents, I tried to almost defend myself and bring out things, which I think aggravated the situation even more. I said, oh, I grew up in a divorced family, mm-hmm. household raised by a single mother. I almost felt I had to pull out things
mm-hmm.
To sort of validate myself and my experience and to say, oh, you know, I grew up I grew up in Mexico, I grew up here, you know, I went to school here. It just, I felt I had to pull out cards to prove myself. And just, she shut me out. And I even felt I had to stay quiet because she was a woman. And I know that, and I try to give space and room for people who normally don't have or don't feel they have a part in the discussion. Now looking back, she has a very strong personality. I don't think I would have, now thinking about it, I don't think I would just allowed myself to be so submissive just because she is a woman. I think I know that her personality, she's strong, and I would debate her and be stronger about it. But I have felt shut out myself. And I did mention that I've known people who've said that they shut out white people out of a conversation simply because they won't ever understand anything and they won't even debate anything with them. So, so I have issues with privilege, and that's hard for me to say here. Yeah, I have issues with privilege. I originally had tried to subscribe to it, and it just brought me to other circles. I went down this rabbit hole, and that didn't make sense for me. So I don't know yet how I see. I think it is the political ideas or the conversations around privilege, I think conventionally work a little bit to talk about things, I think, somewhat to sort of frame things. You know, you, as a person of color, you must go through some experiences like this that white people do not go through. Something like that, I feel that sometimes I use, but only when I feel like I'm too tired to go in depth about my own political stance about things. I think I use it conventionally, but I try to talk in general about things and not say, you know, Mexicans think this way and Mexicans culturally. Yes. I try not to talk like that at all because it doesn't work. So I don't say things like, oh, Mexicans in their culture don't accept gay people because that's part of the culture. I talk about how people think conservatively in general. And there might be some shared experiences around that, but I don't attribute it because you're this. Generally doesn't work, I found out. So, yeah, I feel I'm rambling a little bit. Yeah. But thank you for giving me that chance.
Well, first off, if a person does not believe, if the person does not believe a socialist revolution is possible or even wants that, it's understandable that you would say, we don't want these people here in this discussion. It would be understandable because capitalism lives and thrives off of these divides. It's not by accident that people of, in some places, that people of color don't feel comfortable around white people being there. We are segregated from one another in all sorts of ways. It's very intentional that that separation and segregation exists. And we're segregated in schools. We're segregated in communities. We're segregated by certain sets of experiences. We're segregated rural to urban. I mean, there's just so many different ways in which people are separate. We're segregated in terms of people who are described as, you know, not having a learning disability from people who have learning disabilities. Those, there's so many different ways that people are separated from one another that, and my contention or a Marxist contention is that the origin of that segregation and the people who benefit from that are, is the capitalist class. If you don't believe that, if you don't think that that's true, then you wouldn't want, you would basically be like, it's my group, you know, trying to defend my group and you trying to defend your group. And it's, you know, it's a, I can understand it basically. But if you think it's a revolution is necessary, then the question we have to ask ourselves is, are we going to have a revolution without white workers in it? Are we going to have a revolution without black workers in it? Are we going to have a revolution without people from other nations in that revolution? Are we going to have a revolution without women in it? Are we going to have a revolution without old people? Are we going to have a revolution? Now, the only group I will exclude from the revolution, this is where I would disagree with Martin Luther King, is a white worker might be Martin Luther King's friend, but John F. Kennedy was not. Any, you know, some rich white, some capitalist class white person or black person was not his friend. He, if he thinks he can unite all those into one group, I would say that that's not possible. Like Marxism does say there is a divide. It's not a divide based on identity. It's a divide based. So Marx attempt, since Marx and other anarchists and Marxists and revolutionaries were all trying to change society, and he was saying, look, we got to understand how society is constructed. And he made one basic statement about how societies through history have been constructed that was based on the work of other people. It's not just his idea, but that societies were predominantly organized around classes, right? One ruling class, generally a minority class. Over
economic class.
And yes, yeah. And an economic division that had a social division component to it. But ultimately, society is organized around production, production of food, production of housing, and how society organizes itself around production is basically describes everything else out of it. That's this notion of a base and a superstructure. So the base of society is about a society which is separated between a working class and a capitalist class. The base of society is all the stuff of you know, trees and buildings and tools, means of production. Those things are at the base of society, and it's how are these various things organized, and how are people related to one another in the process of production? He said that is the kernel of how everything. That's the base of things, and superstructure would be your legal system, your education system, your government. Those are the things that come out of that, and those things. It's not a chicken or egg. You know how chicken or egg is like, which one comes first? Base comes first. Base comes first, and everything else is organized out of that to support the base. Okay, but if you're going to fundamentally change the society, you have to change the base. You can't just change the superstructure. because now the superstructure interacts with the base, like the base produces a superstructure, but changes in the superstructure can go back and somewhat jigger the base, but it can't change the base. Mm. You have to have a revolution to change the base. And that's why as a Marxist, I believe that base superstructure formulation is a correct description of society. And so when I talk about where we're going to go to change a society, we're going to have to change this relationship between the working class and the capitalist class. We're going to have to overturn that base relationship and eliminate the capitalist class and make the working class, the majority class, the rulers of society internationally. And secondly, the reason that is possible is not just some sort of idea, but the working class is a collective class. It's collective because the capitalist class partially made us collective in using and bringing us all together to socialize production. That is, if you remove capitalists from anything being produced, actually things are produced from one set of materials is made over here in this city, then it's transported to another place, and then that's built, and then that's sent somewhere else. If you took out the capitalist for a moment, you can see that most all production is done not just on a national basis, but almost on an international basis by a collection of workers all over the place. Now, we don't control that process. The capitalist controls that process, but the process of production is a completely socialized thing. It's a network of workers working collectively together all the time. And the potential basis of our power as a class is the fact that we exist in that place, that the working class is a collective class who only become powerful when we become collective. If I have to make all my shoes for myself or all my food for myself, I don't have any real power. That it's only in my association with other workers as a part of a community of workers, nationally and then ultimately internationally, that my power becomes realized. My power only becomes, and what I mean by power is the ability to change and affect your environment to create the things you need to survive in that. That's really what power ultimately is. That's how Marx defined power, which is the ability to affect your environment to produce the things you need. Now, currently, the capitalist socializes that production, but privatizes the products of that and basically keeps the wealth of that for themselves. And they have two primary things that they need to do. One, they have to exploit all the working class, which basically means exploitation just means you get robbed every single minute of your work. That is, some piece of your work, some value of the work that you're doing, you are not retaining for yourself. The capitalist keeps for themselves. Some people call that profit. Marx called it surplus value. Mm. So that exploitation, that theft, happens every moment, every second for every worker internationally all the time. If it didn't happen, profit wouldn't be produced. Secondly, they rely on oppression. They have to oppress all workers. They have to exist. All workers have to exist in some level of tyranny, of fear, of where they are in worse schools, they're in worse communities, some sort of thing. Now, other workers experience additional oppressions, oppressions of racism, of sexism, of nationalism, of like, you're an immigrant worker. There's additional oppressions that some workers don't experience, that other workers do. But all working class, every worker experiences exploitation because exploitation is the basis of profit. And all workers experience oppression, but oppression is like one of the things that is used to divide us because not all of us experience the same oppression. Mm-hmm. And identity politics wants to organize us around those differences of oppression. That's not going to work. That won't be a way that we can challenge the capitalist. The one thing that does unite us is literally unites us. It's not like in my head, is the fact that we exist in a society where we are a member of a common class. Mm-hmm. Called the working class. And that's why and anything that divides us, whether it be a national border, whether it be a prison, it's one of the reasons why we're for open borders. It's one of the reasons why we're for eradication of prisons. That's not just a moral cause. It's not just like, oh, those are racist institutions. And they are, and they need to be in order to keep the capitalists in power. They need to be racist institutions, but they also need to be oppressive institutions. Because if white workers go on strike illegally, there'll be white workers thrown in jail. And if white workers steal something, they go in jail. But does a capitalist ever go to jail for the theft they do every day as a relationship to profit? No, that's actually legal. It's legal to steal from workers because they're the ones who get to decide what are the laws and private property ownership and their ownership of the means of production inscribed in whatever laws exist are basically, that's how the system runs because those laws keep that base situation of capitalist above workers in intact. And that's the role of the police to maintain that, all that kind of stuff. So the only thing that truly unites us is not some experience or not some identity, but us being members of a working class. And all of us as workers have different experiences, actually. We all have different experiences. But we happen to be members of a collective class that is all experiencing oppression, not necessarily the same oppression. All of us are experiencing exploitation, not even the same level of exploitation. Some people would say tech workers are more exploited than, say, a janitor. Janitors, in some cases, in terms of how much wealth they're generating and how much is being taken from them that they're not getting back. But all of them are being exploited. And so we have an interest in overturning that situation. And if we did overturn it, then we would be able to retain all that wealth for ourselves collectively. Because if we can't do it collectively, then the working class cannot actually reach its true power. If it tries to do it like, oh, we'll just do this for white workers, or we'll just do this for American workers, or we'll just do this for women, it won't work. We won't, one, we won't have the revolution, and two, we cannot actually realize the actual power we have as a class, which is to be able to collectively produce things. Which is why when I oppose racism or I oppose sexism, it's not just on like, well, that's a bad idea and that's mean, although it is mean. I oppose sexism and racism on the basis of it actually keeps our class from realizing its true potential. Not just its true potential in overthrowing the capitalists, but its true potential of actually coming together and being able to run society collectively. Because all these ideas, racism, sexism, homophobia, nationalism, will interfere with the working class being able to rule society in its dictatorship called socialism, the dictatorship of the proletariat. All those ideas will interfere with that process. It will interfere with our ability to make the revolution, and it will interfere with us being able to retain our ability to run society in that way, because these are ideas that interfere with the class being a collective class and interfere with it in its operation of collectively producing things. So that's why when I think about what actually unites us as a Marxist, the one thing that unites us ultimately is us being members of the working class. And it's not a question of identity, it's a question of actually how society is organized. And that's how Marxists look at that question.
And the difference, I suppose, as well with this identity of economic class is that you can jump within those identities, that you can jump from being, you can change, you can be a capitalist, you could change your way if you wanted to and become part of the working class.
There are workers who do find ways up into the...
And the working class that move up.
Yes.
No? And then they become the capitalist class.
Yeah.
So I think that the difference between that identity, if we're trying to talk about identity, is that that one is one that you can move about and take on or not. Whereas being a woman or a black person, or it's not, you can't really change those things. What I'm trying to get at by this is that...
And conceivably you could change your national identity, though, if you like. I just don't think of your people's presence in the working class as an identity question. Identity is something that you ascribe for yourself, and this is sort of like literally a way of looking at society and saying, if you have to work for a wage, if that's the way you make you're able to survive by working for somebody else for a wage, then you are a worker. Mm-hmm. I mean, you may not identify as a working class. You may think of yourself as middle class because you make a certain wage. But when Marxists look at how society is constructed, they don't say, well, how do you identify? They look at it like, how is this society producing things? And where do you fit in that? Mm-hmm. So if you make $30,000 a year, but you're a manager at McDonald's, you're a member of the middle class. Mm-hmm. If you make $100,000 a year, but you make it flying planes or you make it doing tech work, you're a member of the working class. Mm-hmm. Because the way you're making your wage is working for somebody, and you're basically giving somebody your labor power and saying, you can exploit me, because that's the rules of the game, but I'll get some back in the form of wages. Okay, if you make your wealth by owning the means of production and having people use the means of production to make other material goods and selling them on a market, then you're a capitalist. And so wherever you fit in that, you could call yourself a worker because you're doing work. Like, oh, I go to work every day as a capitalist. Mm-hmm. But the Marxists understand, no, you're the capitalist because this is your position in the relationship of the process of production. You're the middle class because you manage people, and you're the working class because this is what you... And again, the reason Marxists come up with this description of society is, again, not just to say, oh, isn't this this cool little thing we can describe how society functions? Mm-hmm. It's because we're trying to understand how to change society. So if we understand how society is constructed, then maybe we can have some ideas about how to change it. So it's a formulation that people find themselves in between, like, am I middle class or am I working class? But it's not one that we ascribe to, like, an identity.
Some people do that, actually. Some teachers don't think they're part of the working class.
Right. Well,
because they're part of the educated class, some will say.
Right. A Marxist would say, well, sorry, you are a member of the working class, unless you're a principal. And then if you're a principal, you're a member of the middle class. You know, if you manage workers, then you're part of the middle class. If you're self-employed, that's usually considered middle class, okay? My partner, who does not make much, makes less money than me, but has a middle class position. Under Marxist understanding of how production is organized, mm-hmm. she would be described as a member of the middle class, mm-hmm. because she's self-employed and does not have to work for somebody for their wage. The role of the middle class is a little different, but Marx considered the class capable of making a revolution that would get rid of capitalism. The only class he thought was capable of doing that was the working class. I agree with that.
So I guess I would be considered, because I am self-employed myself.
You might be a member.
Yeah.
Yeah. Might be a member of the middle class at this point.
I do interpreting services, which is freelancing.
Right. Yeah. I'm not sure for what freelance fits. Some of these things get a little fuzzy, you know. But those of us who work in places that are, you know, like 30 teachers here, 60 teachers there, whatever. I think 80% of the population is roughly working class in the United States.
I consider myself to be part of the working class because I personally, my interpreting service isn't so much. I get paid well the hour, but I don't get health insurance. Mm-hmm. You know, so I there are lots of, I don't have easily, I have to look for work. It's something I have to, you know, I do it from word of mouth, people that know me and different languages. So it's not like for me, it's now I'm able to stay away, to move away from the school mm-hmm. system where mm-hmm. I was working before and part of the same union as before, where now I can be independent, but I don't make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. I make very, very little money, but I'm able to do what I can because I also live a frugal life.
I think from a Marxist definition, I think that would fit in the middle class. But again, people in the middle class can align themselves with the workers in the struggle, or they can align themselves with capitalists, you know, and right now, well, I think in terms of what I understand your positions are, I think most of the values you have are ones that are aligned with working class values.
Yeah, I think I will go in this area. I'm very grateful that you were able to break this down from a socialist perspective, because I think that a lot of people will say, well, how is being part of the working class going to help me fight oppression, the experiences that I feel, the experiences that you feel as a black person, the experiences you feel as a Latino person, the experiences you feel as a person of the GSD, gender and sexual diverse community, are because of the system that we live in. And I think that it's hard to see that when you are living your life in this system and you see how you are not gaining access to certain, shall we say, privileges, where you have, you see there are differences where the majority of the people who are incarcerated are people of color, where you see that a wage gap exists, when you see that there are segregation in education, and you say, well, how can I identify with the working class when these things are actually happening mm-hmm. to me? Yes, they are happening to you, but because of this breakdown that you gave, we have then the system that we have and that we are living in.
And people would also say, rightly, but you can say working class doesn't if you can say working class don't benefit from racism, but I know plenty of racist workers or sexist workers or workers who believe that immigrants shouldn't be able to come across the border, or even ones that should be, like, we're not in the majority when we say we believe in open borders.
No,
like,
no.
And even liberals, even the left, we're not, okay? Say, so yeah. What about all the, like, and all those, only open borders is, we will need to smash national boundaries if we're going to have the kind of revolution we're talking about. We will need to unite across those sorts of
things. Even abolition of prisons.
And abolition of prisons. We are, you've not, most people would not agree with, there's some bad people out there. What about sexual predators? Da, 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 da. What about certain really violent criminals? Serial killers. People always bring that up. I would say the biggest serial killer is Barack Obama, Donald Trump. Those people all go in jail first, but whatever.
And please visit those other episodes that we have already discussed.
Correct. That's right.
Prisons. We've already talked about the prisons and open borders for immigration.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry.
So, no, that's good. And they're right that workers have not come to that consciousness. But if that is the those ideas, those anti-racist, anti-sexist, those ideas of collectivity, that those are the ideas that the workers must have in order to make the revolution that we must have, or that I believe we must have. If you don't think we need a revolution, then you're not going to agree with me. If you think we can get this figured out under capitalism, then of course you're going to be like, what was Andy talking about? But if you think a revolution is necessary, and I do believe a revolution is necessary, I do believe we either have a revolution or we have World War III, and I don't believe there's a possibility of World War IV. There was World War I, World War II, World War III, I think that's as much as we get. We get World War III Part A and World War III Part B, and that's it. Because I don't think we go beyond that, at least in terms of, any ability to have to really produce for everyone, because the world will be a nuclear nightmare. There might be people, but, whatever. So we have a choice. We, in my mind, we either make that revolution happen or it's the ruin for everyone, and if you're going to make that happen, this question of racism will have to be taken up by the struggle, because when workers go into action and go into struggle, just like we saw with the striking workers at the hotel,
the Marriott
Hotel strike, yeah. Mm-hmm. Which were workers of color, predominantly Asian and Filipino, mm-hmm. some Latino, and there were some white workers and black workers. Who did they bring into SCAB? They brought in people across the border, Latino workers, possibly people that didn't even have papers, at the very time when Trump was talking about, immigrants coming across the border. So who do the capitalists bring in? They bring in those workers to scab on that operation. So you have two choices at that point. You can either say, secure the borders and keep those scabs out. If you do that, you might think you're helping your cause, but you're actually screwing your cause from the position of the working class. You're actually strengthening the hand of the capitalist class, who is actually pushing you down as a hotel worker. Or you can say, we need to organize those workers. We need to invite them across the border, welcome them into here, and organize them into our union and not let them be used as scabs. Mm-hmm. Okay? So that's the choice that the working class faces. If it makes one decision, it has the ability to go on and become a more united working class and potentially challenge the capitalists. If it makes the other choice, it will sow more divisions. It benefits the capitalists, no matter how hard you want to strike. If you're a striking white worker in the South and black workers are brought in to scab against you, if you think that you're going to be holding up the Confederate flag to keep those people out or whatever, you're just falling for the same old okey-doke. You're falling for the trick. And workers have been willing to fight for these things. I mean, auto workers around the 60s or 70s when they were going on strike, there were white workers who actually were in support of what's called super seniority for black workers, which basically meant this, that because what was happening was when you're newly hired, you have less seniority, right? Mm-hmm. And the reason they wanted to give black workers super seniority is they were like, no, we need to have, like, we welcome our black brothers and sisters into our union, and we don't want them to be the first ones fired when the layoffs come. So we are going to actually give new workers, new black workers, super seniority, mm-hmm. and bump them up so that they're not the first ones fired when it comes off. And that was not just something that was like, oh, we're being nice people. This was at a time when people were trying to figure out, how do we unite as a class? So this is something workers are willing to do. It's the same reason why workers struggling in the 30s, when we talked about even in
Seattle.
Seattle, how workers wanted unemployment money for people. They wanted health care for people. They wanted food for people because they were recognizing that they were going to, unless we give people something they need, they're going to use to be scabs against us. So
another episode to visit.
Right. So it's and you know, there's examples of the Russian Revolution of women's rights that came as a result, and gay rights that came as a result of the Russian Revolution. This is not just, this was a working class revolution fought not just by gays or not just by women, but by a whole assembly of different kinds of people. But they recognized that they had to basically, they made it where gay sex was illegal across the globe, even in so-called Western countries that were supposed to be enlightened. Mm-hmm. And they completely made it legal in Russia right after the Russian Revolution.
I did not know this.
Yeah. So why? Why would they do that? Was it because gays were running their operation? There were certainly gay people, but there was a growing ferment of equality that people were calling for and asking for. It was asked for by women, but it was asked for by all sorts of people who, you know, had all sorts of different ideas about what kind of love they wanted to have. And basically the quote, I can show it to you here.
This was from a Soviet legislation at the time, declares the absolute non-interference of the state and society into sexual matters, so long as nobody is injured and no one's interests are encroached upon. Concerning homosexuality, sodomy, and various other forms of sexual gratification, which are set down in European legislation as offenses against morality, Soviet legislation treats these exactly as so-called natural intercourse. So this is what
that's enlightened.
Workers will do and can do if they are able to make the kind of revolution that challenges not just a contract or not just a law, but tries to shake up the entire base of how society is organized, that mm-hmm. challenges the capitalist class and says, you are no longer running things, we are running things. Mm-hmm. And it will lead to a festival of openness for women, for transgender, for people who have identified with learning disabilities, for gay, whatever. Mm-hmm. There's going to be all sorts of liberation that comes as a result of it. But it implies that those people will be part of that. Like it's not like gays weren't part of this revolution. Obviously they were. But we don't have to. The leadership of that revolution was the working class, mm-hmm. collectively. You know, and unless it offered liberty for women or gays or people of people in the colonies of Russia at the time, mm-hmm. then they weren't going to be able to have the revolution. So you had to make everyone all in by giving them the liberty they were looking for, so they would be part of your struggle.
Andy, I was just going to say with this as well to add on is that the capitalist class is somewhere or another always known that this is the way that it works. Even in Mexico, where you had the rancheros against the indigenous people population, when the rancheros were going to go into battle for because of land or they needed to feed their families, they said, look at those indigenous lands. Take in Mexico, this is my country, take their lands. And then they would say, those are the stupid ones, the indigenous people, the mm-hmm. Uneducated ones. Mm-hmm. And the rancheros that were mestizo, that were mixed, they immediately, that was the way they separated them. They didn't see them as Mexican, whereas before they saw them as Mexican, and we're all Mexican. Mm-hmm. And Mexico has a long, long, long way. They even have a whole caste system. Not like an Indian caste system, but the Mexican caste system of the Spanish, where you belong with who and what, if you were mulatto, if you were Spanish mix, and what not percentage, because they didn't measure the genetic, but they measured in the color or the different races, and you had to jot down who you were marrying with and stuff. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole way to separate people, and then they put them in places of hierarchy in those right. racist systems. What I wanted to say along with this as well is there's something around this I think that we're missing, which is political correctness, and maybe that we can discuss in a little bit that I wanted to add in, and appropriation, because identity politics delves into those areas where I think that when people talk about this, they think, well, white people cannot participate in this, or black people cannot participate in this because they're not of this. And this happens normally, culturally. This is like cultural war, I would say, more than an economic war. And I wanted to just say, I think when I think of this way of thinking, is that I respect, and even with trans, for example, there are to respect pronouns and to respect cultures, because there are differences, and we want to respect if that's how they wish to be called, or if this is from a particular culture and a particular ritual. But I do think that there are ways for us to learn from even mistakes when we're being policed into thinking that we have to subscribe to a particular way of thought, which is, I think, almost control thought and language around. I don't know if you're understanding where I'm heading with this,
yeah.
But to make us and force us to believe or think and act a certain way. And I so normally see this in universities and college campuses and academia. But it isn't so much that I'm saying that we should be disrespectful to each other, and we should, and we have discussed this as well, that I do value freedom of speech, and I do think that people can involve and get and learn about different cultures. Let's put this in concrete example. I'm Mexican, but there is a big contentious idea here in San Francisco right now around Dia de los Muertos, where white people should not be invited or act or be a part of it. I do think that there are people, especially here being the backyard of the tech, with Silicon Valley, people that come here and use this as their playground. I do think that there are people here who do disrespect certain cultural aspects of people. I do think this, but I don't think it is wrong for someone, if they invite or want to try to learn about a particular culture without making fun of it, without trying to disrespect. But I see everything wrong with Disney and this corporate world trying to corporatize Dia de los Muertos for the benefit of economic gain. And this is what I find is wrong with this. And that's when I think about appropriation. Is that not so much cultural appropriation for from one race to another, which I think we can all share, but more so because of this economic gain to profit from it, because they see and in where they can get more money. And that, I think, is where I think I would agree with appropriation, because it's coming from an economic point of view to try to gain profit from one's culture. But I don't think that people are not allowed to be participate in culture and learn from each other and even be a part of that indigenous culture or learn how to be dress in the part. I don't think that is. And I think that there is this divide, and you cannot do this because you are this and you're that. And the other one that I really, really think that is really, that I brought up lightly and I'm going to get a lot of heat for, is that I do think that there is Islamophobia. I do think. But I also believe that we can look at a particular religion and engage in somewhat controversial discussions around how that belief system works. Because I'm an atheist / agnostic. Somewhat I believe some spiritual things, but I'm more of an atheist. And I don't believe in religion. And I think that that's where people don't want to delve into, because immediately you are tagged Islamophobic. Right?
Right. And we've had this conversation too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I think that that is where these two things I'm talking about, appropriation and hard topics to maybe criticize something, is immediately personal. Anything is just, oh no, you shut out people because of it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, so first off, let's just remember, or from my vantage point, that the fight against racism or sexism or nationalism, or the fight against the fight to make it possible for all these different diverse beliefs to live in one stew. The possibility of that occurs, really is only realized in the context of class struggle. It doesn't occur when it's like a, you know, like the possibility of it doesn't occur when, if it's me and you trying to sit in a room with other people and we're trying to have a good time and we're trying to figure out how to relate to one another. Like, of course we have to try to respect one another and things like that. But the realization of the possibility of real solidarity is only going to be found out in class struggle when we as workers go up against the capitalists. That is the context in which racism will have to be challenged. The racism of workers will have to be challenged. The racism and the sexism of workers will have to be challenged. It's in that context that all these ways we must communicate with each other, all the ability to share each other's culture will be done. Like those, that's the reason for it. That's so one of the reasons things have gotten so heightened around just language and that is because there's not much class struggle. There's no real, we're not even going into the arena in which racism must be fought because we're not engaging the capitalists directly in battle. I mean, that's what it means to have a historic level, a low level of working class struggle in this country, essentially means that the fight against racism becomes almost abstracted because the fight against racism really only takes on true meaning in many ways once we engage the capitalists in battle and we are faced with racism as a divide within our class. We are faced with the fact that black and white workers can't seem to get along for whatever reason. And if we can't find ways of communicating with each other in a more respectful way, of figuring out how do we welcome each other into a common struggle, then we're done. So I do think, you know, we have to figure out our language. Sometimes people have to figure out a way of stepping back so other people can step forward. I think all those things are important. But I want to be clear, we're really not going to learn how to do this until we go on strike. That's one way of putting it. Until we go on bigger and bigger strikes, essentially. That is going to be the school of how to overcome racism, sexism, all these sorts of things. How do we challenge the institutions of these sorts of things? But then what language do we need to use with one another in order to make ourselves build more solidarity with each other? So I'm not saying that these discussions don't have any meaning when it relates to, I want to go to the festival, but you can't come to the festival. But that's not really the test. You know, that is just another aspect of a separated and a segregated society struggling to figure out how to unite when the capitalists are running the whole show. And similarly, I mean, I'm an atheist as well, you know. But I guess what I would say is when we're fighting to get the U.S. out of the Middle East, when we're fighting to get in that struggle in this country to do that, and you run across your Muslim brothers or sisters and you have that question about, no, wait, I don't understand this about your religion, ask that question. I think it's fine. But in a country that is right now dominating the entire Middle East and is using essentially Islamophobia, and most of us have absorbed some level of, we're more democratic, we're less abusive to women, then that conversation is largely going to be the benefit of that conversation of questioning the Muslim religion, probably going to be used to kind of push. You know, it's going to be used by
the reasons why we're going to war.
Yes, yeah. Right. But in the context of a united struggle, yeah, I mean, those are conversations we will have actually with our Muslim brothers and sisters who are engaged in that struggle, with Jewish brothers and sisters, Christians, whatever. Like all these sorts of things, we'll be finding out a lot more about each other than we currently know. Mm. It's not going to be about like, oh, well, let's agree to disagree. We're going to have discussions, real discussions about these things, but in the context of a common fight against a common enemy, where there's not a debate about who that enemy is, or if there is, to the extent that we don't understand as the capitalists, that's going to mean we're going to be fighting each other, you know, and the degree to which we fight each other weakens our cause. So that's, I don't know if it's a little clumsy way of saying it, but those are my thoughts on that.
Right. Well, one last thing before we finish with this video. This is, and then we'll wrap up with this. In one of our episodes that we had, which is entitled what was it?
Oh, interview, Confessions.
Confessions with a former ISO member.
Confessions with me.
Andy Lipson. Yeah.
The episode, I was like, why are we having it? And that's the episode that has like 500 and whatever views.
Yeah, for YouTube. We have other media, but this one, YouTube, is normally we have an average of 100. This one, or less. Sometimes.
Less, yeah.
But this one is... Yeah. Well, the reason why I wanted to, is because of the so many views. I think people are looking at those comments, and I think they're going to be left with that question and that doubt.
Yes.
The question was centered around how do you then...
Why was I against, within the Revolution Organization, why did I oppose forming separate women's groups or transgender groups?
Caucuses,
or
factions.
Caucuses within that.
Within
an explicitly revolutionary organization, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. First of all, this question was taken up by the Bolshevik Party in Russia, where in Russia, the Jews were like blacks, basically. They were the lowest of the low. They were experienced the most segregation, the most racism, the most oppression of all of them. And there was a desire within the Bolshevik Party by some to form a separate Jewish group within it. Mm. And Lenin was like, I get it, but no, this is a bad idea. If a revolutionary group does this, then it makes it impossible for that revolutionary organization to make the argument that we have to unite as a class around this. Now, we have to take up those questions of oppression. And in fact, the Bolshevik Party did. It's why there were so many Jews. Once the Bolsheviks took power, they were seen as a Jewish group, actually, even though they weren't a Jewish group. The capitalists did because so many Jewish people actually took office and took positions of power within the Soviets that were formed and were elected to those positions. So it actually led to the liberation of Jews through the struggle, but it only happened by not allowing the revolutionary organization to go into separate strands, which would have just separated the workers along those. You would have essentially mirrored the separation within the class in the revolutionary organization, which was trying to lead the class into unity. So for a revolutionary organization, I don't think you can do that. I think a revolutionary organization cannot lead a working class into a united fight and simultaneously separate itself along these different identities. I mean, like I said, I get it how if you're trying to just reform capitalism, you might do such a thing. But if you've set the task of taking down capitalism and uniting all workers to engage in that fight, then you don't want that organization, which is trying to unite workers, to be divided along, gender lines or religious lines or racial lines or national lines. You actually want to show and prove in practice and organize workers through the practice of your united working class organization that has all sorts of beliefs within it, that this is the kind of struggle we're trying to lead. A united one of all of us with of different beliefs and different backgrounds, but we all share a common working class. We're all part of the working class, and we're going to lead that kind of struggle. So that was something that I think based on what I see happened in the Russian Revolution and how it actually led to them actually not just taking power that challenged Jewish oppression, but obviously that challenged sexual oppression and oppression of gays and homosexuals. Mm-hmm. I believe that a revolutionary organization has to attempt to organize itself not along identity lines, but along working class lines. Mm. So,
well, I think that you should place this episode under the description area for
the question,
yeah.
Right?
Okay.
Yeah, I'll do that.
Or the episode under the description box. Okay. So thank you very much. Ooh, so that was...
It's a lot.
Yeah, this episode was very well needed.
Yeah. So it would be like an hour and a half or something like that. And there's other things we didn't cover.
Yeah, I think that this would... I was going to say this, is that I feel that this is one of the episodes that is going to be ongoing. And we're not... Like I said earlier, I don't think that this is a complete... This is going... I still have some things that I'm still working through. And maybe I will get, as I unfold those for myself, that I will share those with you in this journey of our
And we channel. Do hope that people who have different opinions,
yes,
and different beliefs from you or from me, write comments, write stuff, and say, no, I don't agree, or you didn't represent identity politics properly, or da-da-da-da-da. Like, we need to learn. So yeah. What we're trying to do is...
Send us an email as well, you can.
Yeah. So we're trying to open a dialogue. But I think it would be better so that everyone can see it, so other people yeah. could maybe well, say, yeah, da-da-da-da. But,
yeah.
you know, so I hope this episode does actually get more responses,
yeah.
comments. I don't know how many people will see it, but I hope more comments come as a result of it.
Yeah.
Because that is the thing you said in the beginning about trying to open up a dialogue around a forbidden area almost, is yeah. partly what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
It was the biggest thing we're trying to do.
Yeah, this is challenging for us because we live here in San Francisco mm-hmm. and the Bay Area in general. So mm-hmm. imagine the backlash that...
Yeah. yeah, I mean, and this in fall, I'm going to be potentially, as a white, male white worker, I'm going to be putting myself forward as a person who's going to be a building rep in a building which has a female black principal.
Mm.
And I think there's going to be people who say, well... You know, you can't, like, there are going to be people who think my opposition to her is going to be based on sexism mm. or based on racism. I don't think that's the case, but I think all these things make it very complicated for people when we just see these things through identity. Mm-hmm. My pushing back against my principal will be on the basis of her being a principal, a manager of us workers, and I believe us workers should run the show, not our principals. And we used to have a white male principal, and I was seen as a pain in the butt. And now we're going to have a black female principal, and I intend on being the same pain in the butt. But I think this question of identity politics and this question of privilege, particularly when I say, and I will say, I don't believe in privilege as a formulation that I ascribe to politically, I think that will, I mean, I do think that's going to be used against me. Yeah, so, yeah. We'll see.
And again, just to reiterate, just so people... We do not believe, under the system, we're not colorblind to things. We know racism exists. We know sexism exists under this institution, this system. We're not stupid and blind to it. I know it exists, mm-hmm. but we already explained or this
we're
system
about
and how
we,
it works and how it functions
and how
and
we fight it
in Congress and yeah. how you can fight it. All right. Thank you very much for staying with us this long. If you've reached the end of this to this episode, please subscribe, rate, review, and share with anyone, with your family and community mm. and friends. And you can find us on BitChute, Google Play, iTunes, YouTube, and iTunes Podcast. Did I say this?
Yeah.
BitChute, Google Play.
And Stitcher.
And Stitcher. Gracias. And Stitcher. Again, rate, review, and subscribe. Thank you.
And hope we hear your comments.
Yes, thank you.
All right, see you next week.
Ciao.
Bye-bye.